If people are dieting now more than ever before, then why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier than ever, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that, instead of turning into fat when you consume it, turns into ketones, which is a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body. So, by getting more MCTs in your diet, you essentially flip a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which can flush out excess fat and calories. And he's created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it's a delicious drink. I love how incredible it tastes. All you do is add a scoop to water, enjoy, and watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized. So, if you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast, go to GundryMD.com/energy and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's GundryMD.com/energy.
You want the best for your child. K-12 can help them gain the skills they need to reach their full potential while giving you the support you need to get them there. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Their state-certified teachers make online learning interactive and engaging, allowing your child to learn at their pace from the safety of home. Join the more than 2 million families who have chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more. That's k12.com/podcast.
You obviously have a very high tolerance for murder.
That I'll never be able to get back.
May God bless your dark, broken soul.
So today is actually supposed to be my July 2018 installment of intimate partner homicides that happened in Canada in 2018. And July is obviously a very important month for me because my niece Taylor was murdered on the 26th of July that year and his parents were murdered on the 31st. And I had this case picked out. It's been on my calendar for quite some time. And then when I started looking into it, there just really wasn't a lot of information available. And then when the matter did go to court, the charges changed. So that changed a lot of the information available, because again, in Canada, things are a little bit different when it comes to information. So then I went to Homicide Canada's website to see, you know, what other homicides took place in July of 2018. They list them all by months and year or whatever. But wouldn't you know, Taylor, Sean, and Alan's cases were not listed on there. And I thought, well, that's not accurate. This isn't an accurate list. Well, it turns out they are listed on there. Taylor is listed as a Jane Doe, and both Sean and Alan are listed as John Doe's. So that just sort of tells me that they, when the month comes to an end, they just list the cases and then they don't go back and update them or anything like that. So I was rather annoyed on sort of both those counts. However, I can tell you that in July 2018, we had in Canada 16 people that were listed as Jane or John Doe's, 4 of them in Calgary. So obviously we know who 3 of those were. Some are listed as the family not wanting to release the names, and some were just unidentified. There were 57 homicides that month, 18 in Ontario, 10 in BC, 10 in Quebec, 7 in Alberta, 5 in Saskatchewan, 4 in Manitoba, 3 in New Brunswick, which was actually the only province in the Maritimes that had any murders that month at all. and nothing in the territories. The youngest was a little girl, 7 years old, Alaya Rosa, killed by her mother, Carrie Ann Lewis, out in Langley, BC. However, in that case, although Alaya was found dead on the bathroom floor in Willoughby Slope on July 22nd, Carrie Ann was charged with first-degree murder. She went to trial on October 26, 2020. And the Crown offered this opening statement that they were going to prove that Carrie Ann had drugged Alaya with diphenhydramine and lorazepam and then drowned little Alaya in the bathtub. Alaya, she was described by family and friends as lively, lovely, confident, and headstrong. She was found face down in the bathtub, and Carrie Ann had alcohol and cannabis in her system. She was also involved in a rather nasty custody dispute with Alaya's father. Dad had had custody since 2016. He'd brought Alaya over to her place around 10 a.m. that morning. Carrie Ann had also broken up with her boyfriend just the night before. So she gathered little Alaya up and they headed out to the drugstore where she bought some candy, a bottle of blue Powerade, a box of Sleep Aid, and which is like an over-the-counter sleep medication, which contains the diphenhydramine. She also brought a 1 milligram dose of Ativan, which is the brand name for lorazepam, and then went to a liquor store and bought a bottle of Smirnoff vodka. And when Carrie Ann didn't arrive back at her ex's place with Alaya later that day, he marched over there. He found her door blocked by boxes and some furniture, called the police, who found her cold, wet, wearing shorts and wrapped in a pink bathrobe. She had actually been dead for some time. She was found not guilty to yells of profanity in the court gallery. Basically, they weren't able to rule out any alternative suggestions, like maybe she had fallen in the tub and because her mom was drunk, it didn't make it a murder. And the defense said, "It's our position that none of the elements of the offense have been proven in the case. The manner of her death is unclear. The cause of her death is uncertain." It was not disputed that Alaya had the drugs in her system at the time of her death and that she had water in her sinuses and like foam coming out of her nose when she was discovered. But it was possible that there could have been a pre-existing condition that could have made her what they call vulnerable to death from a relatively minor head injury. And it could have even just been a superficial bump on her skull. And even if Alaya had drowned, but that wasn't enough to consider it a murder. Quote, "The fact of a drowning does not in itself prove an unlawful act. An accidental drowning is also possible." There was also no evidence that Carrie Ann had dissolved some of that sleep aid medication in the blue Powerade that she had bought, which was kind of what the prosecution suggested. And to make matters worse, that bottle of Powerade had never been collected and tested. And so that was that case. In another terrible case in July of 2018 was the Danforth shooting in Toronto. On the same day that Carrie Ann was murdering little Alaya, over in Toronto, 29-year-old Faisal Hussain took a .40 caliber Smith & Wesson down to Danforth Avenue in Greektown and at 10 p.m. opened fire on unsuspecting pedestrians starting near Logan outside of Christina's restaurant before moving on to Chester, where he started shooting outside of another restaurant called Dimitri's. Then went down to Hampton and Seven Numbers Restaurant. Although it was very random, he did kind of select his victim on a basis that no one has ever really understood. And then when the police arrived, he was found dead from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. He shot and wounded 13 people and killed Reese Fallon and 10-year-old Juliana Kosis. It's important to note here, though, that Faisal had a long history of mental health issues. He suffered from diagnosed psychosis and depression. He had once carved his own face with a pencil sharpener. His sister had recently died in a car accident, and his brother was in a coma after suffering a stroke. He was not on any watch lists. He was not a religious person. His case has never been tied to any terrorist groups. The gun had been purchased illegally from what they call gang-related sources. He had been working at a grocery store in the pharmacy at the time. Reese Fallon had recently graduated high school. She was a political activist who was all set to study nursing in September. She had been out celebrating with one of her friend's birthdays when she was shot. Her family friend said of Reese, "She was the nicest person. enjoying life, living her life. She did not deserve to die this way. She had a promising life ahead of her. Juliana Kosas was a competitive synchronized swimmer who enjoyed dancing and playing with her friends who attended Edward T. Kroll Public School. She was visiting her neighbor with her dad, and they had gone to get ice cream when she was shot. Her father, Donnie, was also shot and had undergone surgery. Juliana also left behind her older brother that she was particularly close to. Juliana's parents had grown up like just two houses apart from each other, so they'd been together for many, many years. And so on that depressing and irritating note, we're going to talk about the murder of Kim Racine, who's from St. Isidore in Quebec, which is south of Montreal. Kim was 24 years old, which is a very statistically familiar number, especially when it comes to murder. About a third of all murders happen to victims between the ages of 20 and 24. And those 4 years make up the largest percentage of murders of people from the ages of 17 all the way to the age of 54. Your best chance of survival from murder is before the age of 12. Once you hit 13, your chances actually go up exponentially. That's just a little FYI for you. Kim was living with her husband, Eugene Morin, but she had moved out. She was described as a ball of energy, and although her mom died in 2017, she continued to work to help others rather than focusing on her own grief. Her dad, Eric, was living in Halifax, but they stayed in pretty frequent contact over the phone or by text. Her very good friend, Stephanie Hogue, said that Kim was full of life, who loved life elsewhere. She was hardworking too. She loved hairdressing and everything manual, trucks, etc. Kim was such an energetic, smiling girl. At any time when things were going badly in her life, she was always ready to devote herself to her friends. She had worked a few odd jobs, but had settled in as a hairdresser at Isabelle Lavoie's salon. Now, St. Isidore, Quebec is not to be confused with St. Isidore in Ontario. The one in Quebec is actually quite a bit bigger. It's a population of about 2,500 people. In Ontario, there's only 721 people. Kim wasn't actually from St. Isidore, but she was staying with her friend Stephanie at her place on Rang St. Simon. And on the evening of July 29th, around 7 p.m., a 911 call came in from that address about a woman in respiratory distress.
If people are dieting now more than ever before, then why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier than ever, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that, instead of turning into fat when you consume it, turns into ketones, which is a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body. So, by getting more MCTs in your diet, you essentially flip a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which can flush out excess fat and calories. And he's created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it's a delicious drink. I love how incredible it tastes. All you do is add a scoop to water, enjoy, and watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized. So, if you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast, go to GundryMD.com/energy and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's GundryMD.com/energy. Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to BadlandsRanch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to BadlandsRanch.com/save50 today.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
And when the paramedics arrived, they found Kim in full cardiopulmonary arrest and covered in bruises, scrapes, and cuts. And when they got her to the hospital, she was pronounced dead. She was already showing signs of rigor mortis when the paramedics had arrived. Now, according to Eugene, who was the one that made the 911 call, he had been visiting her that day and called 911 when she suddenly had collapsed. Eugene was arrested. He was charged with second-degree murder. And because of the nebulous circumstances of her death, the Quebec Provincial Police were called in to investigate the matter a bit further. And what they did discover was that Kim had been actually trying to get away from Eugene. Kim knew that Eugene and her relationship was toxic, it was unhealthy, and she wanted out. And in fact, her dad, Eric, and big brother had been offering to move her out to Quebec City or to Halifax. But according to him, despite the many arguments and breakups, Kim always got back together with him because he promised to change. He described Eugene as jealous, manipulative, violent, a liar, and a con artist. I mean, basically the quintet of domestic abusers. Now, I don't actually know if Kim was staying at her friend Stephanie's house or if it was someone that Stephanie had arranged for her to stay with. But the whole point of her being there was to get away from Eugene. And in fact, it was like such a secretive move that her friend and her boss, Isabel, didn't even know she was there. She had gone a long way without talking to him. This is according to Stephanie, quote, she had gone a long way without talking to him. She had been pushing him away for months. He never let go of her. It cost her her life. Isabel wasn't, like I said, aware of the move, but she was aware of Kim's feelings about Eugene. She said she wanted to get away from this toxic relationship. She said she wanted to leave to breathe. She told me often that she wanted to leave, but you know, when you're being isolated, this man isolated her. So she had moved out about 4 months prior to her death. And the reason I don't actually know if she was at Stephanie's house or not is because, like, Stephanie had no idea how Eugene could have shown up there in the first place. She actually had never been worried about Kim's safety because she believed that she was safe there. It is entirely possible that Kim invited him in because they also discovered that Eugene had written a letter to her along with a bouquet of orchids and a stuffed animal. And in the letter, he had wrote a bunch of manipulative crap, including, I really love you, and being away from you hurts me more than anything else. My heart is broken. I haven't slept. I apologize, and I ask you 1,000 times forgiveness. So when he was arrested, he gave his address at a halfway house in Montreal. So, like, what was he doing in a halfway house? Well, he had been released on parole in May of 2017 from serving about a third of a 22-month sentence for drug trafficking, which was something that Kim and him actually fought about a lot. He had been arrested in 2015 during an investigation into how drugs keep getting sold inside of prisons. It was also discovered that on June 8th of 2018, he had been involved in a scuffle with Kim. And rather than consider that a breach of his parole to fight physically with your girlfriend, they did not revoke his parole. No, why would they do that? Well, because his charges were drug-related, not beat-up-your-girlfriend-related. I mean, you guys are silly to think that the courts care about domestic violence as a breach of parole. As the parole board said, it didn't make him an undue risk to the public. Although Kim might have seen that a little bit differently. And isn't she, being a human, part of the public? Now, he did, however, admit to using methamphetamines and alcohol in the days before that argument, but no matter. In his arraignment, he was charged with second-degree murder, which is fancy pants talk for you killed her, but you didn't plan for her to die. He was denied bail at that time. Her dad, Eric, made sure that he was there to see it, saying, "It's for my daughter. We can't say what happened, but she's no longer there, and there's someone who will be held accountable." So he fired his lawyer, hired a new one, delaying some hearings, of course. And then at Kim's funeral, her cousin said, "Despite the big family that we are, the loss of one of us leaves an empty chair. There is no one who will have the same personality, the same passion, the same je ne veux. It leaves a hole. Last year we lost her mother, and Kim is a big chunk too." But the very large turnout showed Eric that Kim had been very popular and very well liked. And then the autopsy report came back. And the cause of death for Kim was an overdose. And her numerous injuries that she had not actually contributed to her death, according to the pathologist. So they had to drop the murder charge and then downgrade it to manslaughter. Criminal negligence causing death and then assault causing bodily harm. So instead, he pled guilty to, look at this, he pled guilty to failure to provide the necessaries of life. As in, he didn't bother to call 911 until she was well past dead. The defense's statement of facts reads in part, "The accused acknowledges that noting the victim's condition, he should have called for help immediately, maintaining, however, that his own state of intoxication limited him in decision-making," which was something that Eric pretty much jumped out of his chair, saying, "There were shortcomings in the investigators, prosecutors, and forensic pathologists who were not able to prove that Mr. Moran beat my daughter to death." But the defense, doing what they do, came to Eugene's defense, which I guess is what the whole point of what they're paid to do, and saying, "Enough is enough. These are not the facts that are recognized today by my client." The Eugene said in his statement to the court, "I loved her, and I think it's sad that she died. I never hurt her." Never is a little bit of a stretch, I think. Anyways, he got 3 years probation, 240 hours of community service, no jail time, so he's out and about, probably with a new girlfriend by now. He is, however, prohibited from drinking and doing drugs and blah, blah, blah. Now, listen, I totally get that Kim might have been a drug user, and maybe she did overdose by accident that day, and then all the bruises were just from her bouncing off the walls. But if you consider the timing of her death, which was just months after a separation, Eugene, her abuser, was in attendance at her death. He had a history of violence towards her, and then she had these multiple injuries to her body. He doesn't call 911. I don't like to speculate. I don't want to call him a murderer if the province couldn't prove that. But I mean, if you look at the totality of the evidence, it just smells fishy to me. I personally think what we need in this country is like a law that classifies if you die while under like coercive or physical isolation while in a documented violent relationship. I mean, maybe we don't go so far as to call them murders, but there has to be something more than just not providing the necessaries of life. Abuse, bullying, coercive control, those all have been known to lead to a person self-harming, drug, substance abuse. I just hate it when, like again, even if she took the drugs willingly, the injuries, again, she's bouncing off the walls, to watch somebody overdose in front of you and not do anything about it. Like, I know that's kind of a slippery slope as far as your freedoms and all that stuff. It just really bugs me. And I think it bugs me the way Joey English's case bugged me, that she's dismembered and then they rule it an overdose. It bothers me when people do things and then it can't be proven that they did those things. Maybe I'm just mad that she died in front of her abuser instead of in front of somebody who loved and cared about her. And maybe I'm mad that he didn't call 911 out of his own selfish, like, "Oh, if I call, they're going to know that I did cocaine or whatever," instead of thinking like, "Oh, maybe we could save her. And then nobody's going to care what I was doing at the time." I'm, Like, I'm pretty sure unless you hotshotted the person or contributed in some way directly to that person's state of health, no one gives a rat's banana about what you were doing, that you were doing a bunch of drugs together or whatever. And let's say that, okay, so let's say that he came over and he didn't touch her in any way, shape, or form. She just had bruises. Maybe she bruises easily, something like that. And she overdoses. He can't wake her up. So like shit is hitting the fan. If he had called 911 at that moment and she still died, like I wouldn't have a darn thing to say about it. But by waiting to call out of his own selfish panic that, you know, he was going to be in trouble, his finger was going to be pointed at him, he was doing drugs, he brought the drugs, whatever it was that he's panicking about, he waits to call until she's cold and stiff. To me, that is what makes him culpable in her death. Like, maybe he didn't contribute to it in the classic sense of it, although personally, I think he did. But by waiting to get help until it's way past the too late point, that is what makes it criminal. And I'm really pissed that he got off easy. Like, really pissed. Especially with no jail time at all. So, Eugene, I just hope that this experience, you use this experience to clean up and better your life. But somehow, I just don't think that's going to happen. And so with that, that was the very sad case of Kim Racine, which got absolutely no coverage whatsoever. And I think that her story is just as important as anyone else's to tell. I'm going to be back again next week with another episode. And in the meantime, you can do your rate review thing. You can sign up for the exclusive feed on Red Circle. And as always, thank you so much for listening.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.